to have you, if you do have a question to ask, that you would go ahead and bring it up right then and not say wait till the end of the class or something, just because it is probably something that other people are wondering about as well. And I think what I'll try and do is, okay, never mind. Now, the thing about the central nervous system and all the stuff that we're going to talk about, you know, the diseases, the processes, and so forth, the pathology is often augmented by the fact that the brain is really trapped in the fixed cranial fold, certainly in the adult. Now, in children, that's not quite, in infants in particular, the bones of the skull kind of float around and can allow for some expansion and so forth. But when things are trapped in the cranial vault, you have any kind of swelling, you're going to end up with compressing part of the brain. Maybe it wasn't actually injured specifically, but it's now going to be compressed and squished. And so the idea of the fact that the brain is a prisoner inside that fixed cranial vault is going to come and factor into practically every bit of pathology that we talk about here. Now, what this is basically saying the elements that I'm going to be dealing with. So we're going to be obviously talking about neurons to a large extent, and loss of neurons or damage to neurons that lead to malfunction. And within the context of the neuron, there are things that can happen. We'll take a look at kinds of injuries to the brain in which the axon and the body of the nerve cell get separated, get ripped apart, and may never reconnect properly. Where that axon goes, it may never actually reconnect. Even though technically the nerve body has survived the injury, it may not be able to really regenerate an axon to connect back where it was supposed to be. When I say here in the notes that there's no regeneration, I mean there's really no replication of neurons to replace ones that are lost. Now, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that we do have new neurons that come along all the time. They're not very many. They're in the hippocampus. We do make new neurons to replace ones that are senescent and die in the area of memory processing. If we didn't, probably by the age of about 3 or 4, certainly by the teenage years, we wouldn't be able to process memories at all, keep track of where we live, you know, that sort of business. But there is no capacity to regenerate lost neurons, ones that are sort of lost to what I call casualty and accident, in other words, life, things that happen, and just general aging process. Once they're gone, those suckers are gone. I'll say a few words about interneuronal deposits. In the context of certain diseases like Alzheimer's disease and particularly Parkinson's disease, where there are accumulations of proteins, malformed proteins, or at least proteins that are not in their proper conformational state, that will lead to the death of the neuron itself. And that's an important part of disease among aging people. Perhaps in years past, it wasn't quite so important because not too many of us made it to the age of, say, 70 or 80 years of age. And it might be that this is just part of an expected aging process, and it wasn't on the radar screen when Mother Nature designed us, sort of assuming we'd live through our reproductive years, and pretty much at that point we'd kill ourselves off. I mean, individually, of course, not societally. And so the idea that you'd have some very peculiar and interesting people much later in life really wasn't all that important. We'll take a look at glial cells and so forth, because glial cells do have the capacity to replicate. Now, what that means is that glial cells glial cells are kind of the instrument of repair within the central nervous system, but it also means, since they have capacity to replicate, they are the source of tumors. When we see primary tumors arising within the brain, within the substance of the brain itself, they are glial in origin. We never see tumors arising from neurons. Neurons, for all practical purposes, outside of that area in the hippocampus, don't replicate. So they don't have the machinery to do it, so they're not ones that are going to go ahead and grow in some uncontrolled manner. We'll spend a good bit of time looking at coverings of the brain and things that say trap blood or become inflamed. We'll talk about meningitis and the like of that sort. So that's kind of the overview of the structures and where we're going to go. Now back to where we began with that, the whole idea of the business of the brain being in the fixed cranial vault, and anything that injures it is going to lead to swelling. The brain is not much different in that regard, although there is extremely tight fluid control within the substance of the brain. I'd like to point out a couple of things here. The blue line that you see all around here, as you might know, is that is the cerebrospinal fluid that floats the brain. When I'm talking about water within the brain, I'm talking within the substance of the brain itself, within the actual matrix, the connective tissue, if you want to use that term, of the brain itself, not the cerebrospinal fluid. We'll look at what happens when you have problems with cerebrospinal fluid flow, overproduction, and so on, but that is not what I mean by cerebral edema. Now, any kind of injury anywhere in the body produces changes that were typically, or at least on the skin, can be visible. You know, if I ask you to scratch yourself, not really rip up a lot of hide, but just use sort of the ink pen without the ink pen part, and sort of scratch yourself, within 30 seconds, almost everybody would have a little red line, right? Rubor, dolor, calor, tumor, this sort of business, which is a function of histamine and part of the designed part of the inflammatory response to kind of get your warriors into the field to do battle with whatever it is that is the injurious agent, lock down the injury, start the repair process, and so forth. And that works real fine. Say you sprain your ankle. Well, you know the outcome there. That sucker's going to swell up, you know, and you've got something now like you've got a watermelon attached to your leg. And it can swell there, and it's not really all that detrimental to actually have that fluid exiting the vascular system, getting into the connective tissue. It is here, however. And so if we have any kind of injury to the brain, whether it's closed head, traumatic injury, you fall down, you really ring the bell, that sort of thing, or we have inflammation, infections, tumor, even hemorrhage, things like that that would obviously result in a vascular response that leads to fluid exiting the vascular space and getting into the tissue space, now it's going to really play hell in the central nervous system. And this is depicting a couple of things that can happen. This side of the brain over here, really, as you view it, the left-hand side, is sort of our control image, showing kind of the way the brain is supposed to be overall. What we're looking at over here would be swelling in here that would lead to compression of the brain, and part of the brain maybe is being displaced under a dividing membrane in the middle called the falc cerebri, and it sort of squishes it under here. Well, if it squishes it under there, or it squishes part of the brain down between the tentorum, or it squishes the brain stem because of the swelling and compression, and the compression of the surrounding tissue probably means you're not going to have a lot of blood flow at that point because it compresses the small vessels. The external water does. The compression of it means you're going to have decreased cerebral spinal fluid or decreased blood flow into those areas, and they're going to die. That brings up another interesting point about nervous system disease is that location is extremely important. You can lose a whole lot of neurons up here in either your frontal lobes or both your frontal lobes. And what it typically means is you just become a very curious and interesting person. The kind of person that might be fun to have at a party, but not someone you want to live with. You know what I mean? In other words, you can lose a lot of tissue up here, and it just affects your personality to some extent. You lose a very small amount of tissue down here in the central part of the brainstem, say the part that controls respiration, and your genes are out of the gene pool. A handful of neurons there go, and that's it. Something so small we may not be able to see it microscopically. So in this case, the injury within the brain in terms of location is extraordinarily important. So there are two things that are at work here, and that is the swelling of the brain, which is going to occur with any kind of injury, can have essentially remote effects all over the brain. If the swelling is occurring up here, but causes compression of the brain down there, and the brain stem gets jammed down and squashed, and maybe it wasn't part of the primary injury at all, but now it becomes so because of the swelling up in here that squeezes it. So it's the compression of this, and we refer to herniation of the brain substance, such as you see here, in which parts of the brain typically get displaced, may get displaced and really compressed. The long-term problem will be then, or the short-term problem will be, that you end up with decreased blood flow in the areas that are just simply compressed, maybe not involved in the initial injury at all. So these things are going to come into play just about every time we talk about central nervous system disease, any kind of central nervous system disease. Thing that you can see, and you might see, a person isn't necessarily going to come into the clinic with papilledema. They might actually, on occasion, depending on whether there's a tumor or something close to the optic nerve or something of that kind. But what we would see, doctor might be able to see if there was increased intracranial pressure, would be papilledema, would be the pooching out of the optic nerve in the retina. Take a look in there and see if that thing is sort of exploding out. It looks like a kind of like a donut or a bagel sort of coming out into the vitreous. And that's a serious sign. Typically, it occurs acutely, and it isn't like somebody strolls in and says, I'd like you to take a look at my eye and see if I get any papilledema, you know. But this is showing one of the changes from that would occur in the brain stem. And this is what we have here is going to be obviously an autopsy specimen. And we're going to be taking a look at the cerebellum and the brain stem here in this next picture. And it shows a series of hemorrhages that occur in the brain stem that reflect the injury and hemorrhage in the brainstem that was really secondary purely to swelling in the brain and compression of the brain, a compression of parts of the brain, in this case, the brainstem itself. And there is that's all the vital stuff that's telling you what you need to keep breathing, your pH is getting out of whack, that sort of business. And when that stuff goes, then that's the end of it. So that is an example of injury that occurred someplace else. We've had a remote change, remote effect, somewhere else in the brain, secondary to the fact that we got a fixed cranial vault. Now, what we do with this, if somebody's been involved in an automobile accident, and you have, I'll just get rid of that for now. It's an interesting thing. If somebody, say, really has their bell rung, and we know that their brain is going to swell, there are a couple things you can do. One, we can try and reduce the water load by giving them an osmotic substance that doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, but will serve as an osmotic pull to pull water out of the brain. The other thing will be to take out a good section of the skull, and this is done routinely. And they'll cut out part of the parietal bone up here, a good part of it, and let the brain simply swell right out there. And you might think, well, what the hell are you going to do? You're getting the missing part of your skull now. And so, interestingly enough, what they do is they take that piece of bone, and they'll open up the skin here in the abdomen, and they'll put it in subcutaneous fat over your belly. Sew it up, and there it is. And it stays vital. It stays alive somehow. Because eventually, you're going to put that bone back. When all the swelling recedes, you're going to go back in there and pull that piece of bone out, put it back in there, and basically wire it in place, and it'll grow right back into place. And so people who have potentially fatal injury to the brain, traumatic injury to the brain, they might survive if it were just simply a fact that let's get over this period of cerebral edema and let the brain go. Well, what they literally do is let the brain swell right out a big hole and then put it back in there. We used to get the bone down in the lab when I was in hospital, and we would freeze it and we'd keep it frozen. And then when 6 weeks later they'd call for it, we'd send it back up. People actually travel, people do things, and you always want to know which bone's around if you should need it. And so that's why we put it in the abdominal cavity. So someone may have a big piece of bone out of their skull right there. It's not like their brain, the skin is not continuous. Of course, the skin closed up over that. Yeah. It might take about that long, believe it or not, to completely cycle through and pull the fluid off. Sometimes, most times it's not that long, but I mean, they're prepared, and the bone will survive in there, and then it can be replaced into the skull. That's an interesting thing, but we definitely do that. Come on, baby. All right, now, another kind of fluid that we have in the is the cerebral spinal fluid. And cerebral spinal fluid floats the brain. Our brain is so weak and so heavy that we have to float it, literally. And we reduce the effective weight on the base of the brain by almost two-thirds by floating it. The brain is almost all lipid. There's a tremendous amount of lipid, a lot of fat in the brain, particularly in the wrappings around all the axons and things like that, all that myelin that's in there. And it's kind of like me with all the lard I got on board. If I jump into a swimming pool, the first thing that happens is most of the water goes out. But if I jump into a swimming pool, I'm going to bob to the surface, kind of like chicken fat does, you know, when you're making chicken soup, because it's lighter, it's less dense than water. And what you're doing here is you are taking something that's less dense than water and you're putting fluid around it so you actually float it. And you really reduce the effective weight of the brain in the skull, at least on the base of it, at the bottom of it right here, by about two-thirds by floating the cerebral spinal fluid. Cerebral spinal fluid is manufactured up here in the and the ventricles. It moves down through the aqueduct sylvius into the fourth ventricle and then out. And then eventually it circulates and gets reabsorbed in what's not quite on the picture here, the arachnoid granulations up there, and restored to the vascular flow. And this is a constant merry-go-round. It's going on all the time. So it's being produced. And you really have to have this extremely well-regulated. The amount of production here has to be precisely the amount that's taken out up here in the arachnoid granulation. And for most of us, that's exactly how it works. It works just fine. Now, this is not cerebral edema. I'm going to talk a little bit about increased cerebral spinal fluid. That is not cerebral edema. The edema was water here in the brain, substance in the brain, kind of like water around your sprained ankle, where it was a consequence of the injury. Here, we're often taking a look at genetic abnormalities, things that happen, or developmental abnormalities, in which such things as the aqueduct sylvius doesn't form properly. And so the fluid that's manufactured in there really cannot get out, can't complete that circuit. There are two ways in which problems with cerebral spinal fluid flow can manifest themselves. We refer to it as hydrocephalus in general, but there are two ways, either something that's a communicating or non-communicating hydrocephalus. But anyhow, the majority of it is due to some kind of developmental abnormality. Fluid accumulates in the ventricles. The kid has a quite malleable, the infant has a very malleable skull, and it will start to grow as the brain increases in size. Well, the brain's increasing in size simply because there's increased water, increased cerebral spinal fluid in the ventricles. And again, that is not fluid in the brain. I mean, it's not within the substance of the brain. Another, that would be one possibility. You can imagine that if you had an aqueduct sylvius that was very small, you wouldn't be able to move the fluid. The other thing is this. The fluid that gets out into the cerebral spinal fluid space and floats the brain can ultimately come back up here directly to the ventricles. It has to be able to transit a relatively narrow area right here at the base of the brain. It goes all around and goes to bathe, essentially, the spinal cord and so on. But it has to be able to come back up here. And if we had somebody who had scarring across this area right here, say had acquired it, because of some inflammatory process or autoimmune injury process, and the scarring at the base of the brain would restrict the flow, then we would have fundamentally the same effect because the cerebral spinal fluid cannot get as quickly or efficiently back up to the arachnoid granulations. So we see problems with hydrocephalus that involve congenital as well as acquired conditions. Essentially, it is an obstruction at some point of the movement of cerebral spinal fluid. This would be sort of the classic appearance of a kid which has a, say, a malformed aqueduct sylvius. We don't see that to any extent here in the United States. This is not something that's real easy to fix, but it is certainly fixable. And other parts of the world where you don't do a lot of neurosurgery on kids, that this can occur. You can actually see some pretty strange-looking heads because this is not necessarily fatal. As long as the skull can continue to expand in size based on the amount of fluid that's accumulating inside the ventricles, it's not going to really compress anything to a great extent. What we do is you put a valve in here. There's basically a one-way valve that can be installed and connected to a plastic tube, and it's run under the skin, and it comes down and either dumps the cerebral spinal fluid directly into the vascular system or all the way down into the abdominal cavity and dumps it into the peritoneal cavity. And that just keeps in. And the valves are adjustable because you don't want to have too much. You don't want to have not enough spinal fluid. You want to shunt it away, but you don't want to shunt all of it away. And so we can adjust them. There are a variety of different kinds of valves. One of the guys I used to teach with over here had a stroke. He had a bleed. And we'll talk about that a little bit here. But he had a bleed in the subarachnoid area, and it screwed up that base of the brain area so that the blood of the cerebral spinal fluid doesn't flow. And he has a valve. He got it when he was about 50 years old. He has a valve in his which helps to bleed off the extra fluid, the fluid that's being manufactured, and has to be adjusted periodically so that if there's too little, he has the granddaddy of all headaches. because there's not enough cerebrospinal fluid to flow to the brain. If there's too much, then there's compression of everything around it, and it hurts just the same. Well, in this particular case, you can do that with these kids. One of the problems with the child that you will not encounter, it's not going to be encountered with the guy I thought with, is that the kid's going to grow. And so you got a piece of plastic tubing that is not. And so here periodically we have to change the location or something. And these things also occasionally get infected. So this would be taking a look at a situation where we either have an inherited inability of the arachnoid granulations to remove the fluid efficiently, or where there's an obstruction and leading to this kind of appearance. Here is the appearance of, and grossly, of a, obviously an infant that did die with it. And this is a CAT scan or an MRI showing that. And what we call non-communicating hydrocephalus, it means it cannot get out of the ventricles at all. It can't communicate itself into the subarachnoid states. In the communicating form, it can, but it cannot get back up to the arachnoid granulations, or something's happened to those guys. And sometimes with vascular inflammatory problems, we actually will scar up some of that material that is used to reabsorb that fluid and restore it to the vascular flow. And so the communicating form says it can get out of the ventricles, but it can't either finish the transit back up where it started, where it's supposed to go. So those are two different forms of hydrocephalus. I want you to understand the difference between cerebral edema and hydrocephalus. They are not the same thing at all. Hydrocephalus might occur following trauma based on how things could get screwed up. It could, in an adult, it could happen after inflammation and so forth. Most of the times we see it in children, certainly when it's developmental, because of something wrong with the conduction system out of the ventricles. That's not a very happy picture now you think about it. You know, there is a comment. Yeah.
I was just wondering, so with both non-communicating, is it both an excess cerebrospinal fluid or just one?
It's a problem. It's almost always a problem of movement.
Okay.
That it can't get where it's going. There are people who make more cerebrospinal fluid than they should. We see that again occasionally in children, and there is a way medically of sort of toning that down some, but that's kind of unusual.
So they're both, or does it just fluctuate? Like, does it both? Are they both gonna have like an excess of cerebrospinal fluid, or not enough, or is it just?
In the untreated condition, there will appear to be too much cerebrospinal fluid because it accumulates. It's typically it's a problem. The streets are clogged. There's been an accident out there on 3rd Street. You're trying to figure out how to get around it somehow, and you're all backed up to the mall. But there is actually, I mean, on occasion, we'll see somebody who is arachnoid granulate or choroid plexus inside the brain is producing too much. That's kind of unusual. It's producing so much, it's a flood in the system. Yeah. Most times it's a problem with a movement. All right. Let's take a look here at trauma. Trauma can start right at day one. Trauma may mean hemorrhage in the brain. It may mean a closed-head injury with relatively little bleeding. Here are a couple examples of things that might occur at the time of actually delivery, birth, that might lead to potentially some injury to the brain. This one on the top here is what we call a cephalohematoma, and really you can see it's external to the brain. It's not actually within the cranial vault at all. There's a hematoma, there's a blood body, there's accumulation of free blood in a particular area. And the skull is so soft in babies that blood accumulating outside under the skin may actually sort of dimple the bone itself in. It's almost all cartilage at that point. And it may sort of dimple it in and push it in so that it compresses the brain. So this right here, we can usually see with problems with delivery or where they've used forceps to change the position of an infant at the time of delivery and inducing trauma there. That's different than a situation where trauma occurs at the time of delivery that leads to actual bleeding on the surface of the brain. And that's what that's depicting right there. These are the similar kinds of hemorrhages that people can have in adult life based on trauma or ruptured blood vessels based on extremely high blood pressure. But it can lead to death. Again, it's often the compression of the brain right here. In this particular case, maybe it's compression of the motor strip. And the compression of that means that development, or at that moment, well, for the next few, for a little while, the compression squished the brain in that area, so there was relatively little blood flow. And so those neurons died. Sometimes kids have the remarkable ability not necessarily reproducing those neurons, but reassigning duties of other neurons so that in time you don't quite have the cerebral palsy. This is when the kid with cerebral palsy cannot coordinate motion and so forth, have trouble walking and so on. And in this particular case, it could easily be due to cerebral hemorrhage here, where the hemorrhage compressed the brain. The compression meant relatively little blood flow at that time through the capillaries that kept the neurons alive, so they died. So again, it's a compressional kind of thing often. Now here's adult trauma we might see in adults. I'll talk a little bit about so-called closed head injury, crew and contra crew, a particularly an interesting problem where the brain gets rotated very rapidly. Here we see we can have hemorrhages in the brain that are related to penetrating wounds. And here we see where the secretary has placed the letter opener into the boss's head, sort of making a statement. But sometimes things that get thrown in there not necessarily penetrating from the outside, it'd be chips of bone, where the skin itself is really not ruptured, but the skull is broken and bone gets driven into the brain. Well, obviously, this has got a blood flow through it. Your brain has got more blood at any time flowing through it than any other part of your body. And so ruptured blood vessels there, you've got a lot of blood flowing, you've got potential for hemorrhage clearly. But the problem, again, is there's no place for it to go. The smallest amount of blood up there can lead to compression of surrounding structures, notwithstanding the fact that there's been direct injury, possibly traumatic death of neural tissue from the injury itself. So the whole thing then is going to be compounded by the fact that you have accumulation of blood, so maybe a hematoma or something, within the brain, and there's no extra room for that free blood that leaks out. So contusion, by the way, contusion of the brain can occur because, again, the brain is inside the fixed cranial vault, and there are, very tough membranes that divide the skull, divide the compartment into various subcompartments, like the fossa cerebri and the tentora. And those can serve, the brain will get slapped around in there, and it might actually serve to rip that thing which normally divides the cerebral hemisphere. The brain gets pushed under, and it might actually cause tear in your brain tissue. A laceration is a tearing of tissues. If you fell off your bicycle or you really had some sort of serious sort of deceleration kind of injury to the skin, you'd rip the skin, rip it open, rip the tissues below, and that is a laceration as opposed to an incision. An incised wound might be something like this where you've got a sharp object that actually cuts as opposed to tears. And you can tear the tissue of the brain because there are areas in it which are fixed compared to other areas. Those parts that are immediately adjacent to the fossa cerebri, if everything gets pushed hard against it or under it, the fossa is very rigid and it tears the brain tissue tears across it. So we can have lacerations, we can have contusions of the brain, in other words, bruise. A contusion would be injury to tissue that doesn't involve ripping of, say, like the skin, tearing the skin open, but you all know you can get a bruise pretty easily. What's happened is you've sort of stretched the tissues below the skin, torn the tissue, even though the skin itself remained intact, and you develop bleeding and a bruise. Same thing can happen here, where a contusion, a deceleration kind of injury to the brain, will lead to broken blood vessels and bleeding, even though it's now a lot of tissue, say torn tissue, lacerated tissue. So those would be examples of traumatic injury to the brain that leads to hemorrhage. One of the interesting features of the way, that the brain is trapped in the fixed cranial vault means that injury, sort of the deceleration, the energy of deceleration can be transmitted around the brain and show up in areas you don't expect. We refer to coup as the stuck side, that's the French word for strike, coup and contra coup, the opposite side. one of the more classic kinds of injury will be a frontal impact, say, of an automobile accident, but all the damage or most of the damage is in the occipital lobes of the brain, where we end up with blindness, occipital blindness, because that has been injured more so than the actual point of impact. So we will see injury on the impact side, the so-called coup side, but because the way the brain kind of comes forward and slaps, and there are a couple of reasons that looked at why this occurs, the brain kind of slaps back and recoils on the other side, we'll see most of the damage, in fact, is on the opposite side of the impact. And doctors have to be aware of that, and you will, I'm sure, eventually have an opportunity to see people who unfortunately have that kind of thing, where their visual apparatus is completely intact, nerves are completely intact, you know, lateral geniculus, whatever kind of stuff. I have all totally intact, medial. What is it, medial or lateral or something? Okay. But they can't see anything because they've had, you know, enough injury to the occipital, and they've never had an occipital impact. It was something that occurred frontally. This happens to be an example showing someone who came off of a horse. Could easily be a bicycle or an injury from say motorcycle, where your kind of head's down like this, and the impact is right there. In this case, the person wasn't wearing a helmet, came off the horse at an angle, smacked their head right here, and we're obviously not looking at the surface, the upper surface. We're looking at the base of the brain, and a lot of the injury, and that's where all this is right through here, all of the injury is on the bottom of the brain. Well, the bottom of the brain was not actually what was hit. That was the opposite side. That was the contra coup side. And so you have to be aware of the fact that the way the brain sort of slaps around, as well as the way the skull kind of focuses, almost like a lens in a way, the sort of the energy of deceleration, such that it may focus it on a very small part of the brain, and that's what occurs with frontal impacts and then occipital blindness that occurs later. before I want to be sure I have the before we go on to this, I'm going to say a few words about something which is relatively new, and I am sorry to say I don't seem to have in the notes. So we're going to come back to that picture in just a minute and look at actual broken blood vessels. But in terms of other kinds of injury of the brain, it may seem subtle. If we take a look at, say, CAT scans or even autopsies of somebody, but something can be extremely important, and I mentioned this before, and that is the separation of the axon from the nerve body. And today, we actually see this because of high-speed car accidents, and especially things like automobile racers and so forth. And that is that the brain is constructed with the gray matter on the outer surface. And actually, we have gray matter inside, too, where we have nuclei, cranial nerve nuclei, and things like that, where the nerve bodies live. But when you take a look at what sort of drives our thinking process and our motor and sensory and stuff like that, those nerve bodies are all on the surface, right? That's the gray matter. Help me out there, am I right? Am I close there? Yeah. That is considerably denser than what's immediately beneath the white matter. The white matter are all the tracks, basically the axons that are running around, some of which are going to other nuclei, other areas within the brain, some of which are exiting in forms of cranial nerves. That is considerably less dense. There's a lot of myelin covering around those axons and so forth. The nerve bodies are sitting up here, and some of them have extremely long axons. Now, if you have a very rapid rotatory motion, say in the case of a high-speed car, in this case NASCAR, let's say, ripping along there at 200 miles an hour, and that thing rotates extremely quickly, what will happen is that the heavier stuff on the outside doesn't move quite as quickly as the rest of it does of the brain. And you can literally shear off, you can rip right off all the axons from the nerves themselves, from the nerve body. You understand how that can happen? You're twisting and some stuff, some part of the brain is more stable, slower to move than other parts. And what you end up with is this axonal injury. We refer to it as diffuse axonal injury. And they may never reconnect. The nerve body may still be alive, but the person is a screwball the rest of their lives. They may have significant motor and sensory deficits because the axons from those nerve bodies didn't know where to grow it. And it's going to try and regenerate it. It's going to know the axon is missing, but it may not be able to exactly go to the same place where it was supposed to, where it did developmentally when you were in your mom's tummy. So in that situation, we only will see the most subtle injuries, the most subtle changes on CAT scan, where maybe there are some little tiny specks of hemorrhage that show up or little bits of fluid that accumulate where a lot of axons were ripped free in one particular area. This was not really an issue, you know, when we were developing, when we were evolving. We were out there chasing each other around in the Serengeti Plain, and, you know, some days we got the cheetah and some days the cheetah got us, kind of thing. Swinging through the trees, you don't generate a whole lot of rotatory motion. You don't generate a lot of speed. I mean, this is something that we see today because we've got devices that will propel us at speeds that were just, you know, incomprehensible, really, even not that many years ago. And the rotation, just simply that rotation. I'm not talking about an impact that rotates the head. I'm talking about the whole body being rotated very quickly and parts of the brain shearing and moving across one another. So diffuse axonal injury is something that's pretty doggone new in terms of the human experience, but it can leave a person with what would appear to be intact intact neurons, but no longer connections where they're supposed to go. Okay. Sorry for the omission. I do have a slide of that, which shows a guy being kind of corkscrewed around. All right. Now, this slide right here, I kind of ripped off out of your textbook, and it's showing two different kinds of hemorrhage. I guess on occasion people could have one or the other, but it's one slide designed to show two different things. So, and there is no normal here. We're going to talk about first one side, then the other. We can have hemorrhages within the brain, one of which can be due to rotational kinds of things on the surface of the brain. What we talked about before was laceration and penetrating wounds of the brain, which led to hemorrhage within the substance of the brain itself. Now, we looked at even little hemorrhages that occurred when there was increased pressure. We looked at the brainstem hemorrhages that occurred there with the first few slides. This is hemorrhage that occurs on the surface of the brain, technically external to the brain itself, but can lead to death and can lead to permanent loss and so forth because of the compression of the brain. Again, you don't have any room for any extra fluid, any extra blood, anything extra in the central nervous system within the cranial wall. And if you do, you're going to compress parts of the central nervous system. So let's see which one of the ones here I'm going to talk about first. Just stay with my notes. Okay, a subdural. A subdural hematoma is one that occurs beneath the dura. Now, this bright pink line that you see going all the way around here and continuous out of here to make the fall and so forth, that's the dura mater. We have three layers of meninges, right? What's the dura mater mean? Tough mother, right? And it is a tough mother, I'm going to tell you. It's a dura mater. It is like shoe leather, and that is essentially the interior lining of the bone. And it's very slippery. Things can move across it. And then you've got the arachnoid and the pia mater that actually sits right smack on the right on the surface of the brain. In this case, what we're looking at with a subdural means that the bleeding is beneath the dura, but you'll notice that the arachnoid, is being compressed, and the dura is not separated from the bone itself. It's still right there. This is the kind of bleeding that we do see with sudden stops. Particularly in older people, again, rotatory motion doesn't take very much. Granddad falls down the stairs, and he acts kind of slowly because he's rang his bell, you know. And then what happens, slowly there may be some blood accumulation, and then he starts to act really funny 3 days later. What happened in that event was there are bridging veins that extend from the surface of the brain up through the dura mater into the bone itself right there. And those little bridging veins are very delicate. And an old user like me who's had some shrinkage in my brain, they're sort of stretched a little bit. And if you rotate the head, and this is different than this thing I was talking about, diffuse axonal injury, okay? A surprisingly small amount of rotation with those stressed and stretched veins can lead to them tearing. And so they will accumulate blood out in here, not between the dura and the bone, but between the dura and the arachnoid. And it can accumulate very slowly. And so Vandad may not be acting real squirrely, immediately after an injury like that, may not even remember. This is also the kind of injury we see in alcoholics who spend a lot of time with their head down in the gutter or banging their head on things and they can't remember. They've also got a problem. Alcoholics also may have liver disease, so that they've got problems with clotting proteins, and then they can't actually clot the blood effectively. So they end up carrying these. And it can occur in somebody your age without a question, particularly in an automobile accident or something where there's a quick bit of slapping in the brain, and then it doesn't matter whether you've got shrunken up brain and stretched blood vessels or not. There's enough motion within there to actually shear these little bridging veins so that you start bleeding. And it's slow. Since it's venous bleeding, it doesn't go very fast, right? It's not like arterial side. Venous bleeding, if you poke a hole in you had, it's all venous bleeding, it just sort of seeps out. It doesn't squirt across the room the way it would with arterial bleeding. And so the accumulation of blood is fairly slow, and so the person may not start acting squirrely until they've got enough of it there for that thing to actually compress enough brain tissue that now they're really localizing neurological signs. Either they act strange, or they've got problems with motion, problems beyond cognition, sensory and motor. And so that would be due to this. So we go in there, we obviously can remove that and drill a hole in there and suck the blood out. But that's a venous bleed, okay? A subdural hematoma, subdural bleed is a venous bleed. And it can occur at any age, but we tend to see it in more or less older people begin because of the stretched veins and so forth. And then, but always it has to do with really sheer, little bitty delicate veins. But the important thing is it's slow blood accumulation. Let me just say a few words about the other one over here, and then we'll take a break. And that is the arterial bleed. So now we're going to move over here. And what you will notice here is with this one, the so-called epidural, above the dura bleed, notice that the dura has separated from the blood, from the skull, the compression of the brain is going on. And what's almost always the case here is there's some kind of a skull fracture and a breaking of one of the major blood vessels, arteries. And now you've got arterial bleeding. But the dura is really tough and it's hard to separate it. And so it may still require some time for the arterial bleed to start peeling that dura away and cause compression of brain. The classic example here would be a person who's hit in the side of the head here in the temporal region where you have such a very small, very thin and delicate bone. And the middle meningeal artery runs right up through here, runs a little channel on the inside right through the bone. And if the bone is broken and fractured and it's sharp and it tears and it ruptures that artery, there will start to be the arterial bleeding and separation of that. Now, if you can hit in the side of the head, say on an automobile accident, or somebody clobbers you and you fall down and hit that, break that, then the actual impact will often render a person unconscious, whether you break the bone or break the blood vessel or anything. So if somebody's had their bell rung, in a football game, let's say, or something, you're knocked out, you're rendered unconscious because basically, I don't know what just happened in here, but we're going to assume that there is no bleeding at all. You would accept the fact that somebody could be hit in the head and rendered unconscious momentarily. Blink your eyes. Thank you. Okay. So what typically happens is this. Somebody has an injury sufficient to actually fracture the bone and rupture that blood vessel. But because the impact at first, bingo, did that to them, they were knocked out. They were rendered unconscious for a moment or two. And then they wake up and they're looking at their car saying, well, crap, what am I going to do with this? Now I got a side impact. I kind of blew the stop sign. I was knocked out. The cop comes and says, I think we ought to take you over to the hospital. I said, they said you were unconscious when it came. I'm feeling pretty good now. Because what's happening is they're waking up from the event of the impact itself. But what's happening here is this is beginning to bleed. And it may take several hours for it to bleed enough to separate that and compress the brain. So they don't take you to the hospital and have you checked out. And you go home, and you go to bed, and you wake up dead. Because what happens through the night is that you have this slow hemorrhage here. Even though it's arterial blood, it's still got to work hard to separate the dura and it compresses the brain, and you die from brain compression. Epidural hematomas are arterial bleed associated with fracture of the skull. Subdural hematomas are venous bleeds that are separate. They occur because of tearing of those tiny little bridging veins that occur between the brain and the bone itself. One's very low-level trauma, the other is pretty significant trauma for it to occur. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and take a look at some specific examples. If you come back on the hour, I would appreciate it.